Okay, folks, well, I'm at the top of the hour, so let's get started here. First of all, I'd like to thank you all for taking the time and the trouble to come into my reading room. This is a relatively new venture for me. It seems a simple enough idea, and I gather it's not that rare over here, but for a British author. We don't do things like that so much. Well, you know, you can get broadcast on the BBC, but that's, you know, that's especially, and that's usually the works of Jane Austen and things like that, not authors coming on with their own books. But it's a very good opportunity for an author to share what they've been writing, and also, more importantly, why they wrote it and some of the background information that doesn't necessarily appear in the book. I think that's an important point to make, because, you know, I know some authors, when they do a reading room, just sit and read from the book. Well, it's kind of logical, since it's a reading room. But I feel that'd be very disappointing, and I don't feel that would serve anybody so well just to read from the book. So I will accompany it with thoughts and ideas that come to me as we go along. You know, I will be reading from time to time. Today, I've got a particular end in mind. I want to look at some of the background technicalities of this subject. I don't want it to sound technical, but it is very fascinating. The way the mechanics work, and we don't really fully understand how they work, but after 37 years of clinical experience, I can tell you they're very consistent. The observations have to have some explanation, and we think we know what the explanations are. But, you know, the deeper science still evades us, mostly because expensive scientific studies and investigations are just simply not being done. There's no money in it. You know, just eating better and feeling healthier doesn't make any corporation richer, doesn't enrich doctors even, really. So nobody's taking the trouble. I suppose, in a sense, that's one of the reasons why I became one of the preeminent people in this, because in Britain, it was all the same to us. You know, you get paid whether or not. And there wasn't really the same financial interest or same financial bias in choosing what you were going to do and what course of action you took with a patient. Okay, so and I mentioned this briefly last week. I'm not trying to be repetitive. I'm trying to hammer home things that are important. But I do want to explain and make sure you fully understand this hidden allergy effect, or the masked allergy effect. I'm continuing for the moment to use the word allergy. If you remember, I explained that it's all kinds of things. It's intolerance, allergy in the classic sense, allergy in a more broad sense, and also this thing of genetic incompatibility. The actual origins of the problem are not so important as to how it behaves, of course. In science and investigation, we call that empirical study, or empirical research. Means just based on what you see. You see what you see, and that's all there is to it, whether you've got a theory or an explanation or not. So this mechanism is based on countless empirical observations by doctors like me going back 50, 60 years in some cases. The great figures in this field are Randolph, Rinkel, and Zeller, three authors that wrote probably the very, not the very first food allergy book, but the first important one. And one of the books that certainly opened my eyes to this. And it's very important that we understand this mechanism. It was discovered by the man I've just mentioned, Rinkel, Herbert Rinkel. He was a US MD, and he made a tremendous contribution. This was back in the 30s and 40s. And his own health story was really the key to it. It turned out that he had an allergy himself, and he discovered it by accident. He found that he was allergic to eggs, and it was rather odd because he was eating eggs every day. But this is the key to the mechanism. You see, this is what happened. When Rinkel went through college, his folks, who are from down in the country somewhere, Kentucky or somewhere like that, they were farmers, and kept sending him eggs, got him well supplied with eggs, dozens of eggs, probably hundreds of eggs. And he had no money, but he had a lot of eggs. So he ate eggs morning, noon, and eggs for breakfast, eggs for lunch, and eggs for dinner. Plenty of protein, I suppose. But he had a problem. He suffered from severe catarrh. In fact, he describes it quite graphically. When he was in the dark room working on chemical baths, developing photographic sheets and papers, He would have to lean over the sink, literally, and the snot, the mucus, would run from his nose to the floor. Great long strings of the stuff. I'm sorry, it sounds pretty horrible. But anyway, that's how he describes it. Very severe, in other words. So he had severe catarrh. He ate a lot of eggs. Nobody ever put the two together. Because he was eating eggs every day, and he had catarrh some days, it wasn't so bad other days, so it couldn't be the eggs, because, you know, he ate the eggs yesterday and today, and the catarrh isn't so bad today. Well, you know, that's what throws people, because that's exactly how it behaves. Now, what happened, this might not have been discovered, but what happened was that either the hens stopped laying, or the trains stopped running, or something. Anyway, what happened is that for a few days he didn't get any eggs. And so he had to eat other things, and the catarrh totally cleared up. So that was interesting. Even then, he may not have quite put the two together. He was a clever man, but, you know, coincidences like that happen all the time. One of the coincidences, for example, I know that people describe to me is they have gastroenteritis. They have diarrhea and vomiting. They throw everything up. They pass everything out through their seat. And they feel wonderful, and they never realize that that's because they've expelled all the foods to which they're intolerant. They've expelled everything by the by the third day of gastroenteritis. And so the person feels great, they feel terrific, they feel energetic, they wonder why, you know, after 3 days of illness, why they should suddenly feel 15 years younger and their brain really be streaming like it never did since they were teenagers. Well, that's why. It's because when you clear the substance, then the symptoms disappear. But people just often, in my experience, don't make the connection. Anyway, the reason Rinkel made the connection was that when he went back, the egg supply was resumed. Supplies got through from town on the farm. And he went back to eating eggs. And the first time he ate a couple of eggs, he passed out, literally. He just went unconscious and fell on the floor. It was a disaster. Just within moments of eating the eggs. So at this point, it was very difficult not to notice the connection. And he started putting it all together, and this became the explanation of what we call the masked allergy, that if you eat the food every day, you often don't notice the reaction. The body gets by in a sickly sort of way. You eat the food, maybe one day you don't eat the food, and some days you eat a lot of the food, but there doesn't seem any connection. The symptoms are bad on one day. Maybe you have a day when you don't have any symptoms at all, and you eat the food, and you think, okay, it couldn't be that food then. But just trust me, that's the way it behaves. It's very difficult to spot these things, and that's what stopped them coming to light. But with, you know, thanks to Herbert Rinkel, it all came to light. And the explanation is simply this. If you eat the food on a regular basis, and by regular, I mean at least twice a week, the importance of that is that our bowel transit time, the average bowel transit time, is about 4 days. So you've only got to eat it two or certainly three times a week. And it means you're never free of that food. There's always some of it in your body somewhere on the way through. So it doesn't matter, actually, whether you ate it that day or not. The food is inside you. So you're not really unmasking the effect. It's only when you go without the food for at least 4 days, sometimes more, but for at least 4 days, that you actually pass the last of the food out from the bowel. And at that point, you can truly judge whether or not it's having an effect for you. So that's why when we encourage people to do exclusion diets, I'll be explaining next time. Next time is very much the how-to section, how we do it. But this is the understanding of why. You have to do at least 4 days. On the morning of the fifth day, it was usually possible to predict pretty accurately that the person would feel better. If they were going to feel better, that was the day. They'd wake up feeling terrific. And we're often surprised that I was able to be accurate in predicting that. But it's nothing more than knowing this mechanism of Rinkel's. Once the food's cleared the bowel, the symptoms will clear. And the allergy, the intolerance, the genetic incompatibility, whatever we're going to call it, is then unmasked. So it's not hidden or masked anymore. There's no protection. So when you go back to the food, you get hit by it, you know, full force. So if it's a bad one, you're going to feel very unpleasant, like Rinkel did with the eggs. He actually passed out. He was so ill. And these reactions can be really quite severe. They can put a patient into bed for a couple of days, and the patient is often completely amazed and puzzled how it can be that a food that they were having every day should be able to hide itself in this way. But that's how. So as I said, it's not really hiding. It's always there. So the amounts in the blood go up and down, but it's always there. It's only when you clear it properly and then eat it that you can get a full reaction. And that's the basis of what we call the food challenge test. Now, one of the problems with all kinds of allergies, except the most severe kind, you know, when you eat a peanut and you can't breathe and get rushed off to ER, that's pretty dramatic, but that's very rare. The problem with the other kind of reactions is that they're not severe enough for you to be able to tell what's going on. They can be quite subtle and quite changeable, and the reactions can vary so much that it becomes really a very obscure problem. And that's what stopped it being discovered for so long. I think it's one of the great breakthroughs in medicine and healing to realize that not just food, but other things, things that you inhale, you know, this can happen with cat fur, dog danders, it can happen with dust and pollen, and it can even happen with chemicals. We used to use the word chemical allergy, very controversial, of course, but it's not technically an allergy in most cases. But still, you know, the person reacts unpleasantly to the surrounding chemicals. And again, the same thing. Let's say it's a chemical at work. Very often the person would go home for the weekend and do a complete sort of detox. They would breathe out all the chemicals. By Saturday afternoon, they'd probably breathe most of it. And by Sunday, start to feel well again. But then they go back to work on Monday morning, meet the chemical, and feel yuck all over again. That's at least one of the reasons for the Monday morning blues. It isn't all just because you hate work. Okay, so I do hope you understand this idea, this hidden or masked allergy idea. It's very crucial. And as I said, it disguises itself. It's called hidden for a good reason. A person can be eating this food for years, decades, and never realize. I had a lady who had migraine. She was 63 years old and had migraine every week since she was 60. Sorry, since she was three. That's 60 years of migraines every week. Nobody could solve it. She took every pill. She still suffered. Turned out to be milk. She'd been drinking milk all her life. And when she gave up milk, the migraines stopped coming. But, you know, nobody had ever suspected that. And yet the reaction was quite severe. And in that case, I like to tell her story a lot because people think, oh, I bet she was very pleased to find the cause. She wasn't. She was mad as hell because she'd had 60 years of suffering and nobody knew what it really was. And when it turned out to be just milk, she was plenty mad. Now, the key to this is the frequency. If you understand my explanation, that we'll go back to foods, just foods, not chemicals. So if you follow my explanation, it's while there's food in the bowel, then it means you've got to eat it at least twice a week. So one of the inventories I always used to get my patients to do was to make what we call a diet survey, and I'd ask for a list of daily foods, a list of weekly foods, twice weekly foods, I should say. And somewhere on those lists were the things that were causing the trouble. I also used to ask one or two telling questions as well. I used to say, is there anything you know makes you ill? Any food that you know you react to? And sometimes it's quite funny. A person would say, oh, I'm very allergic to pork. And they don't eat pork. And they'd say, well, you've just told me you eat bacon twice a week. Oh, yeah, I eat bacon, but not pork. And they say, well, excuse me, bacon is pork. It's derived from the pig. Oh, yeah. And people often don't spot these connections. And so, you know, milk allergy, milk reaction is very common. Everybody's heard of that. But have you thought that beef is the same animal? It's from a cow. So we have a saying, in fact, anything from a cow. Sometimes if a person's bad with beef, bad with dairy, they shouldn't have cheese, milk, yogurt, or any of those things. They're all the same food. So looking for frequency, you'll see that you get a very different picture. It's not the amount, it's the recurring. I don't care if a person even has a tiny amount. The person has one cup of coffee a day with half an ounce of milk in it. That means they're having a half an ounce of milk every day, and that's very significant. Much more so than quantities, remember. Frequency, that was the big key to finding everything. Now, this also ties in with what I was talking about last time. Remember, I spent quite a bit of time talking about addiction. An addiction and this masking effect are very closely interlocked, because what actually is happening is the person is repeating the dose often enough to relieve the symptoms. It's like a fix. Sometimes it's every day, and if it's something like coffee or caffeine, it's maybe every couple of hours the person is fixing on something to relieve the symptoms. So what happens is the body creates a subtle draw, a subtle magnetism to this food. And without necessarily being aware of it, you know, and feeling that they're hooked on the food or they're crazy for the food, nevertheless, the person is eating the food regularly because of this hidden subconscious drive. The body is looking for the fix. It's looking for the relief of those symptoms. And maybe a person has realized, or their subconscious, their inner processes have realized, if they go more than, say, 4 hours without caffeine, the headache starts to come on, the irritability and the metabolic shutdown starts. So over the years, the person is trained to go and seek out a caffeine fix every few hours, and that sort of relieves the symptoms, or the expression is masking. That's why we call it a masked allergy. It's not just hidden in the sense of a hidden allergy, but it masks or covers up the reaction so that you'd never guess. If you eat the food regularly, you'd never guess. And that's why it's really quite critical to exclude things. So now I hope you understand that, and I hope you understand the link with addiction. And what happens when a person goes on an exclusion diet, by the way, I don't know how many of you have even got the book, never mind tried the diet, how many of you are listening. But you will be aware, or you're warned if you read the relevant chapter, that you often get quite sharp reactions for the first few days. The first day is not too bad, the second day is worse. By about the third day, people often feel they're coming unglued. You know, I've had accounts from patients many times of lying on the bed shaking so loud that the vibration of the bed can be heard in the next room. It's like, really like cold turkey. That's not common, but it happens, and food can be that severe. So you need to bear that in mind. So any clue, any example, or any suspicion of a withdrawal effect immediately raises the suspicion that there's something you're addicted to and something that you're craving that is actually making you ill. You see, a heroin addict, this is obvious, a heroin addict will take heroin because they feel better. It relieves the symptoms. So it's quite logical to take a dose. That's why they crave it. They feel lousy if they don't get it, but as soon as they get the next dose, they feel better. And it's exactly the same thing with food. So if you know, for example, that if you miss a meal, you become extremely grumpy or irritable, or that you get a headache, or you just know that you're pretty unbearable if you've really needed to miss food, then it's a pretty strong clue that there's something going on in your diet, and it's one of the most important things that you should look for. So don't forget that, a very useful tip. I think that's enough of that. I'll just go a little bit deeper and talk about that in relation to Hanselier's general adaptation syndrome. I think I mentioned it last time, actually, so I don't want to beat it to death. But he noticed, it is crucial, though, if you understand nothing, and understand this, it'll serve you well in life for a start. This is stress in general, but particularly we're talking about food reactions, so I'll tie it in only with that. When you first meet it, you feel bad. You get an unpleasant reaction, like when you first smoke, you know, you go green and want to vomit. But if you persist, then it gradually, your body becomes adapted to it. It's the same with a food. A kiddie, often as an infant, they'll be given cow's milk, they get colic, they get belly aches, whinging and crying all the time. But people persist because they know milk is good for the baby. They've been told that, so they keep giving it milk. And eventually it becomes adapted. So that's the sort of second stage. And that can go on for years, decades sometimes. But it's still not a friendly food because the person isn't sick all day long through drinking milk. It doesn't mean it isn't harming them. All the time it's eroding their general body defenses. And as time goes by, something's going to give. And the onset of the symptoms has really got nothing to do with the onset of the allergy or the intolerance. The symptoms switch on suddenly one day, just at the point when the body can't take it anymore. Then that's really the only reason the symptom suddenly begins. It may be at a time of stress, you know, the person may have a virus, or maybe something bad is happening in their life, they're going through a divorce or something. So the extra stress and overload is just the last straw that causes the last bit of tolerance of the food to break down, and the person suddenly has overt symptoms. From then on, they're back to how they were in phase one. If they eat it, they feel lousy. But now it's more serious because there are no defense mechanisms left. And that's what Hanselier called stage three. Now, I added a stage four for food, which is this addictive part. The person feels bad if they have the food, if they have it again in stage three. But by stage four, the person is covering up those bad symptoms by repeated dosing. In other words, we're back to the masking, the addiction phenomenon. Okay, so let's take a look. I think I'll look beyond the overload factor. Let's look at the subject of target organs. This is another key concept to be able to grasp. One of the things that completely bewilders patients and doctors alike, and still bewilders most doctors, because it doesn't fit with what they've been taught. They only understand disease as one cause, one disease. You know, one bacteria causes one, like, you know, a throat or a pneumonia or a bladder infection or something. And they never understood this. They never taught this multifactorial aspect of illness. But what actually happens is that most illness doesn't relate to specific triggers at all. It just relates to this overload factor. When things get to be too much, and overloads can be a mixture of virus attack, not enough sleep, not enough vitamins, eating lousy food, stress at work, stress in the home. All of this is overload, and at some point, something is going to snap. And the something is the key to the symptoms. It's what we call the target organ, the shock organ, or sometimes known a bit more technically as the end organ failure. And that's where the symptom comes from. It doesn't come from the food. So if you're allergic to, say, wheat, if it attacks the bowel, if that's the target organ, you begin to get colitis. If it attacks the lungs, you might begin to get asthma. If it attacks the skin, you get a skin rash. And the very, very commonly attacked organ is the brain. In fact, in almost every case, the brain is affected in some way. It can be very mild. Just fatigue is probably the commonest brain symptom that you meet. I would say 70 or 80% of people suffering from this phenomenon suffer from an inexplicable adverse fatigue. And it's tiredness that's not helped by rest. That's one of its characteristics. You know, you're tired, you go to sleep early, you wake up, you're still tired, maybe tireder than ever, and you drag your feet to work. And people begin to wonder, you know, gosh, you know, am I growing old? I mean, I'm allergic to wheat. If I stay off it, I'm fine. You know, I can work till 10 or 11 at night, I'm okay. But if I have wheat, then I feel tired by 6 o'clock, and I start thinking, gosh, I do work hard, maybe I should have a holiday and stuff like that. Because I'm aware of it, but most people are not aware, so they don't spot this. But so fatigue, very common, and the other one is slightly foggy thinking, slightly, in fact, we used to, brain fog is a good word for it. I prefer woolly brain syndrome, but it's simply you're not as crystal sharp as you once were. That means the brain's being affected. Now, I'm going to talk a bit more about brain allergy shortly, so I'm not going to dwell on that just now. But that's an example of one of the target organs. It can be anything, anywhere. It can be several organs. And what's particularly harrowing for the patient is that it moves. And doctors have a lot of trouble with this, believe me. The patient's in 1 week, they've got a rash. Then they're back in the office 2 weeks later, and this time they're having headaches. And then they're back a month later, and their joints ache. Could it be arthritis, doctor? And then they're back. They're depressed, and so, and the doctor just thinks, oh, this is just hogwash. This person is just malingering, or they're hypochondriac. There's nothing really wrong with them. All these vague symptoms, they don't mean anything. And they'll often send the person to see a psychiatrist or try to, or they'll often make their own snap diagnosis. This person's depressed, stick them on an antidepressant or two. Or they may think it's anxiety, so they stick them on an anxiolytic relaxant pill like Valium or one of those. And often, certainly in the old days, for the patient, that was the end of it. They just got buried under chemicals, and there was never a solution. It wasn't the real problem. The real problem was not a Valium deficiency, so how is Valium ever going to solve that? And they'd never look in the right place. So that moving around, very flitful, protean is a good word there. I don't know if you know that word, a good English dictionary word. Protean means it's changing form and changing shape all the time. It comes from the Greek god Proteus. Proteus was the son of Neptune, or Poseidon, and he used to appear to humans in various forms. So to say a symptom is protean means it shifts all the time. It can take different forms. As I said, a headache 1 week and then can't breathe the next week, then they've got bellyache. The other thing is that the symptoms are often very bizarre. This is usually related to brain allergy. The person's perceptions are altered and they get really weird feelings. The patient will often find that they can't really describe properly what they're feeling. Sometimes it will sound like a mental illness to a doctor. You know, a person is feeling unreal and depersonalized, for example. I used to have that on my list. In fact, I'll tell you what, I already put this on the computer screen. I ought to read you some of these symptoms, I suppose, that were on just a very simple, basic questionnaire. But this is a list of target organs troubles. It's lengthy, but it will only take me about 2 minutes. So let me just run through these quickly. And I used to say to people, it was question 7, since your symptoms started or in the last year, have you had any of the following? So you can consider this for yourself, or if you're listening because somebody you love and care about is ill, does this apply to them? And any of the, and a lot more, but these are the key ones that I used to pick. Red or itchy eyes, bronchitis, meaning, you know, a chest infection. It's often not a chest infection at all. It's just an allergic reaction. Asthma, itching, eczema, blotches on the skin, mouth ulcers, indigestion, abdominal distress. Do you know that one? That abdominal distress when it's very unpleasant and heavy and hard in the stomach. Or flatulence, the person is belching or farting. Abdominal bloating. Now, that's a real giveaway. I've seen people put on several inches on a food challenge test, put on up to 6 inches in minutes, not hours, minutes. It's quite dramatic. Pains in the stomach, constipation, diarrhea, variable bowel, unusually slow or rapid heartbeat, especially the rapid palpitations was a very strong clue to a reaction to a food. Pain in the chest, got to be careful, of course, that it's not heart attack and things like that. High blood pressure, cramps in the limbs, feeling faint, feeling unwell all over. Again, that's a sort of vague one, and that's very typical. Stiffness in the throat or tongue, you know, mouth swellings, water retention, terrible thoughts on waking, shaking in the morning, slow getting started in the morning, crabby on waking, difficulty waking up. Do you remember I described all those last time? Those are all clues to addiction. By the time the person wakes, they're going into food withdrawals. They've been hours off food. And this rotten feeling first thing in the morning is very characteristic. Abrupt changes of state from well to unwell. That's one of the classic symptoms of what I'm talking about here. Person is fine in the morning, they're ill in the afternoon. They're okay next day, but then by lunchtime they're ill again. It comes and goes. Degenerative disease doesn't do that. If it's an infection, it doesn't do that. If it's cancer, it doesn't do that. But if the person's fine some days and they're suddenly ill, almost certainly it's a reaction like that. Skin rashes of all kinds, aching muscles, swollen painful joints, headaches, including migraine. The number one cause of migraine, 90-odd%. Convulsions or fits even. Remember I told you, I think, last time about a boy who used to have convulsions, he had epilepsy, if he ate anything in the carrot family or anything related to carrot, like parsley and celery. Giddiness, nausea, frequent urination. Funny one, that. We've got brain fog we were talking about, woolly brain. Irritability, that's a grand one. It's very common. In fact, violent outbursts, as we shall be hearing. Panic attacks, it's one of the causes to think of. Feeling unreal and depersonalized, it's surprisingly common, that one. And a person saying that they would feel like they were seeing themselves down at the end of a long tunnel. Low mood, of course, but mood swings, very characteristic. The person's cheerful one day and they're depressed as hell the next day. A few days depression, then they're suddenly okay again. Very typical. Sudden sneezing, that's obvious. Sneezing, we all know, is an allergy, but people don't realize that food does that. They only think of cat fur and pollen. No, food. If you eat a potato and you're allergic to it, you'll sneeze. It's a common reaction. Menstrual difficulties in women, that can trace down to this. The woman can be a lot better if she sticks to the right diet. General slowing down or general speeding up. The speeding up's important. That's being sort of revved. I'll tell you about that shortly in brain allergies. Person might vomit without nausea. They just throw up. The body just rejects the food, but they're not nauseous and sick. That would suggest food poisoning or something like that. Sudden tiredness after eating or sudden chills after. In fact, sudden anything after eating has got to make you think of this. But sudden tiredness, you know the feeling, you have a big heavy meal, you fall asleep on the sofa. That's very characteristic. Feeling totally drained and exhausted. Now, I know a lot of people have that symptom, and I can tell you that 90% plus of the time, it's exactly what I'm talking about. It's a food reaction. The person removes the offending foods from their diet, and they feel great. That's why you hear so many good stories, you know, people go on the Atkins or the Perricone, whatever. So because of the changes that they made, they gave up something they were bad with, usually wheat and dairy. Low-fat diets usually ban milk, so anyone's allergic to milk's immediately going to feel better and think, oh, you know, this is my problem was too much fat, and it makes me groan because it wasn't too much fat, it was the dairy. But you see how this works. Eating binges, you know, where a person will suddenly start guzzling food like there's no tomorrow. They buy a bag of cookies, they eat the entire bag within an hour or two and feel terribly guilty. They can't stop once they start. That's very characteristic. And then a flu-like state that isn't flu. A very classic. Sneezing, I mentioned, you know, sneezing, they get a runny nose like catarrh, aches and pains, and the person says, oh, I'm coming down with a cold. But, you know, the next day or the day after, they're fine again. It's not. It's a food or another kind of allergy reaction, but commonly a food reaction. The real flu would take a week or 10 days, and you feel a lot worse than that. But most doctors don't know that. They hear of this cold or flu-like thing, and they never, never think of food reactions. Whereas a famous allergist, famous might be the wrong word, but a great pioneer allergist that I admire immensely, Arthur Coker, he used to have a saying that you eat colds, you don't catch them. Because, you know, he knows about food allergies. He wrote a book, in fact, about food allergy testing. Okay, that's good. So the next mechanism I'm going to talk about is what we call thresholds. And that really means, well, let me tell you an important Scott Mumby saying, which I developed about 25 years ago. You don't need zero allergies to get zero symptoms. Think about that. Think of what I'm saying. You don't have to get rid of everything in order for the symptoms to go away and you feel fine. All you have to do is reduce the load to within the threshold of what the body can tolerate. So if you understand that threshold idea, you think it's quite logical. There's one catch to that, which is that the threshold can move. If you're under great stress, your threshold is lowered, so you react to things that you would otherwise get away with. And in the reverse, you may react to something regularly, but if you reduce other aspects of stress or load, then you find you can suddenly tolerate it. And that's why the most common reason why people feel great when they go on holiday. Everyone thinks, obvious, you know, vacation, of course you feel good, of course you feel happy. But trust me, this is one of the key mechanisms why that applies to a person. They go away from their home overload environment, so they're free of the, you know, the mold and the dust, they're free of the psychological triggers. You eat differently, always you eat differently on a vacation. Often you go to warm places, so logically when you're on vacation it's more salads and, you know, less wheat and stodge and dairy things. So a number of reasons why that would apply. So that can increase your threshold so that you're able to tolerate much more. But this threshold thing can mean that bad foods will throw you straight over the threshold. They're bad. Every time you meet them, wham, you go straight into symptoms. They have a high density, if you like, of symptoms reaction that will automatically push you over the threshold. But you can have lesser substances that on their own wouldn't cause any problems, but then when you run them together, it all adds up to enough to cause symptoms. I always use the same example because, you know, when you're live on TV and things, you need to think quickly. So I've just got used to always using this example. A person who's has a chocolate, they're allergic to milk chocolate, dust and cat fur, right? They have a chocolate milkshake, then they go into the attic and they stroke a cat and they start to sneeze. So they say, oh, I must be allergic to cats. But it's not as simple as that. If they hadn't had the chocolate milkshake, it wouldn't have happened. If they weren't in the attic, it wouldn't have happened, and so on. Do you get the idea? So those are cumulative things, one after the other. But you can also have them cumulatively at the same time. Say, you know, you're okay with, oh, I don't know, you're okay with banana, you're okay with melon, you're okay with coconut, but you put all three together in a smoothie, and you suddenly get a reaction, because all three together is just more than your body can cope with. So, do you see? So there we are. There's another very serious complicating factor. It's as if the whole game is designed to confuse people that don't understand the game. First of all, the target organ shifts around, and that makes it confusing. Secondly, the person will sometimes react to the food and then not another time. So that throws another complete spanner in the works. the person is, say, marginally allergic to wheat, they need quite a lot of it to trigger a symptom. So most of the time, the person doesn't notice any connection. But then they're sensitive to, say, citrus fruit. So they have a slice of bread with marmalade on it. That's orange. And all of a sudden, wham, on comes the symptom. And the person might say, I wonder if it's marmalade or sugar. But they miss the fact that they're reacting to wheat. So, and some days they'll eat too much wheat and feel really bloated. And they think, oh, I wonder if wheat's a problem. And they have a few days off wheat and feel better. And they say, I know, I'll try wheat. So they have a slice of bread and nothing happened. So they think, oh, I can't be allergic to wheat. But they're wrong, because it would have taken two slices of wheat to reach the threshold. Or a slice of bread plus a pizza. Or a slice of bread plus a cookie that's got wheat in it. Do you see? So you can understand just how complicated this can get to be. And, you know, the pioneers that made the discoveries and, you know, the things I found and the mechanisms that I observed, really, you have to understand the whole story. That's all I can say. That's why I wrote the book, Diet Wise. It isn't just how to figure out your food allergies and intolerance. It's understanding what the heck is going on. Because, in a way, you haven't a chance. You know, it's almost impossible to sort it out. People sometimes do by good luck. You know, it's wheat. It's pretty clearly wheat. Someone says, I've heard of wheat allergy. Do I do you stop wheat? So they stop wheat and they feel great. And that's the end of that. So that's a good story. But for most people, it's complicated. It's more than one substance. And there's this, I think I mentioned before, my friend Doris Rapp, Dr. Doris Rapp, great pioneer American doctor lady, she used to talk about the 8 nails in the shoe trap. And she says, if you pull 6 nails, or you pull 7 nails, you're still going to limp. It still hurts. You need to take out all 8 nails before you're comfortable. So it can be a bit like that with food, not usually 8 at once, but maybe it's 3 or 4 at once. So if you give up 1, nothing happens. Give up 2, nothing happens. Give up 3, nothing happens. But you give up 4, and suddenly it all goes away. And then the person jumps to the conclusion that the last thing that they gave up was it. Whereas in fact, it's all 4. So can you see just how very confusing it can be? The procedure that I take you through in the book, starting in chapter 12, will get you over all those particular hurdles. So don't be afraid. And there are also, you know, quickie cheats. If you get really stuck, you could try blood tests or try and find a doctor who's capable of doing the right kind of intradermal testing. But really, this book is written for somebody who wants to try it for themselves and really, really wants to work it out for themselves. And you can do that. If you're patient enough, you're determined enough, it's not difficult. Okay, so I said I'd go on then and talk about brain allergies. To me, this is one of the most fascinating aspects of this whole thing. And it's where I made most of my reputation internationally. It's where I got known as the, you know, the weird and wonderful allergy detective stories. I saw the weirdest things, the weirdest behavior changes. And you wouldn't believe, just on a simple thing like a food. One of the examples, for example, is a girl I think I've mentioned before. I can't remember what I said last week, actually, but let me give you an example of a girl who was allergic to potato, and she acted like she was drunk. Now, alcohol and drunkenness is just selective poisoning. The alcohol poisons the inhibition pathways first. Eventually, if you keep drinking, it poisons everything. So you fall on the floor under the table in a coma. That's what alcohol does. It's a poison. But what it starts by doing is selectively poisoning inhibitions. So you suddenly feel great. And you feel you can change the world. And you feel sexy and like Superman and, you know, watch out Arnold Schwarzenegger. That's the release of inhibitions. Well, that's what happened with this girl. A potato poisoned her brain, but it poisoned the inhibitions first. So if she ate fries and potato foods, she'd get drunk. And I mean drunk. She'd slur her words. She would stagger, was certainly not fit to drive a vehicle. She would pass a breathalyzer test because it wasn't alcohol. But she certainly couldn't pass a sobriety test. you know, she couldn't walk the white line. She couldn't do the finger-to-nose test or any of those to save her life. She got seriously drunk. So that's an example of how the brain can be affected. Okay, so I want to talk about that and some of these extraordinary cases. The first example I can find of a description of a food allergy Again, this was brought to my attention by one of my patients back in 1981. She was a well-read girl. And I've made no secret that I learned everything, virtually everything I know, I learned from patients. I didn't learn from science books. There's little or nothing in science books about this. But patients are often extraordinarily intelligent, self-aware and understanding. And if you're not arrogant like most doctors are and tell them to shut up so that you can say your important stuff, but actually listen to what the patient's saying, which is the real important stuff, it's amazing what you can learn. Anyway, she told me about this. Robert Burton is a well-celebrated writer in Britain, a very classic writer. He lived in the 16th century, 1577 he was born, and lived in Oxford, the so-called City of Dreaming Spires. If you're an Inspector Morse fan, that's Oxford. And he lived there, but about 500 years ago. And he wrote a famous book called Anatomy of Melancholy, which was published in 1621. And in that he said, much to do with milk causeth melancholy. Well, in fact, more technically, he said, milk and all that comes of milk, as butter and cheese, curds, etc., increase melancholy, whey only excepted, which is most wholesome. He's wrong. Some people do react to whey, but he's right, it's not so common. Usually the person reacts to the fat of what's called the phospholipid faction in milk, but those who are allergic to casein in the milk protein are going to react to whey for sure. Anyway, the point is that he'd noticed even then, he'd no clue what food allergy was, but he did realise that dairy products were capable of making people very moody and depressed, and I can only say that he's right. But it can go the other way. It can make people overexcited, violent, aggressive and overstimulated. So there we are. So Robert Burton. Now, as I said, we're talking here brain reactions, and they can be very subtle. But a great teacher of mine, Theron Randolph, noticed that it tends to be to a plan or to a pattern, that a person can become more and more stimulated or more suppressed mentally, according to the effect it has on the brain. Again, back to alcohol, okay? If you take a small dose, it stimulates you. You know, if you have a couple of gin and tonics or a scotch, you're ready to save the world, and you suddenly dream up this $100 million idea. You've got the answer to everybody's political troubles. You know, you're certainly overstimulated, talkative and very garrulous. That's on the positive or stimulated side, and you might think, well, that's good. I'm not sure, even at that level. But certainly we all like that kind of mildly stimulated, you know, where we're active, we're alert and lively and enthusiastic, we've got unimpaired ambitions and lots of energy. This is so desired, it's often considered normal, but it's not normal. Well, it may be normal in the sense of common, but it's not healthy. Healthy is on a totally even keel, totally balanced and relaxed, chilled out, no reaction either way. So in this state that I've just described, you're a little bit stimulated, and it's getting unhealthy, because if it gets any worse, you end up tense and jittery and hopped up and overstimulated. You can get aggressive. Person gabbles too much. They stumble over their words. And the person can, in fact, reach complete violent manic stages, mania or overstimulation. That was the stage that was reached by my famous Irish boy that got murderously violent when he ate potato. It just revved him up so much that his only expression was to try and throttle his stepfather, try to choke him to death. But that's on the, and when it gets really bad, then the person just goes into convulsions and they become helpless anyway. But on the other direction, it can suppress. And it's important to understand that you will go up and down. When alcohol sends you up, you must come down. We all know that. If you drink alcohol, you get excited and talkative and giggly. Well, you're going to pay. You're going to pay with a headache, sleepy, feeling very dull, and wish you hadn't. We call that a hangover. And it's the opposite effect. But sometimes people dive straight into the suppression. They dive straight into the fatigue, the slow thinking. Oh, lack of energy. Oh, I can't cope. I can't do anything anymore. Yada, yada, yada. You know, down and down and down like that. They dive into the low reaction. The important thing is to understand it's up and down. If you go down, you've got to come up. So when you come out of that depression phase, then you've got an overcompensation phase. If you go into the overstimulated, jittery phase, then you've got to come down and you're going to, at the very least, fall asleep because of it. And those ups and downs of addiction are very typical when you know what to look for. They are in the book. They're on page 81. They're very fascinating. And they were described by the late Ted Randolph, as I said, the great doyen of this. He was my teacher and taught many of us a great deal about what all of this meant. He gave me permission to publish this table years ago before he died and make it as widely known as possible. And I put it in virtually every book since. It's interesting that we can accompany that with a table of similar ups and downs to do with sexual stimulation. You might think that's very obviously connected at first, but in fact, it's just a kind of neurological, you know, sophisticated neurological stimulation. And the same thing runs in parallel. It doesn't happen with everybody, but you've seen it often enough. You're not puzzled by what I'm saying. You know, let's take a girl, typically a woman, for example, who has too many cocktails. She gets excited and giggly and stimulated, is likely to become very flirtatious and very easy to take to bed and have sex with when she probably would defend herself very, very strongly if she hadn't been drinking. That's the stimulation phase leading to sexual stimulation too. And the opposite, you know, when the person's on a downover, I mean, you couldn't make love to a woman, I don't think, when she's having a hangover. She's gone down the other side, is completely suppressed and depressed, and there's little or no sexual stimulus. She would tend to appear rather frigid and very cold and remote sexually at that point. I hope you're all comfortable with me talking about this. I mean, it is important that you understand that mechanisms do work this way. Any food can do it. That's one of the things that I learned. You know, you can forget the sort of champagne and oysters story. Any food that, if it stimulates a person, is capable of causing a kind of sexual arousal or stimulation effect. And I've seen that with things as peculiar and ordinary as chicken and ice cream. It was never suspected. But you know, once you go through this phenomenon of unmasking the allergy and then reintroducing the food, you can see what it's really doing. And of course, I'm talking about people who are not sexually aroused all the time, but you know, they do tend to be a bit excitable, and they, without realizing it, found themselves being quite sexy and salacious, prurient, I think is probably the best scientific word. They're rather prurient, without realizing that food could be doing that to them. And you don't need to, if you know one of these foods, you don't need to take special so-called aphrodisiacs. That's one of the disappointing things I've got to report to you all, which is that there is such a thing as an aphrodisiac. Definitely, but it varies from person to person and from time to time. Okay, now let me look. I've got a question here from Gary Sutton. Oh, he wants me to talk about NAET. Well, Gary, we'll have to wait till the end. Okay. You are getting through now. And it's something I'll deal with in question time at the end. It's not directly relevant to my explanation of the mechanisms that's going on here. Where was I? I was talking about brain. Oh, yes, the brain allergies, which is arousal and depression, and relating that to sexual function. So there's something to look out for. You might notice that in yourself. You might notice that in your partner. It can be quite risky, of course, this sexual thing, if it's inappropriate and the person's unaware of it. I had a case which made the media very widely of a girl who came to me. It was her observation, actually. She said, "I think that vodka sends me off sexually." And anyway, I put her through the treatment program, and there were various reasons why that might be true. So we decided finally, anyway, we'd test the story. So I filmed and carried out a double-blind trial experiment. We had 10 shots, 10 syringes, all loaded with different things. Most of them were loaded with just saline, just plain water at body strength. Four of them had alcohol. There was gin, whiskey, vodka, and brandy, I think, was the other one. Anyway, she had one of these every 10 minutes, and we gauged the reaction. We measured various things like her pulse response and other things. And it was all being filmed, as I said. And on, I think it was the fourth or the fifth injection, she suddenly became very fruity and said to the cameraman, "I hope you've got a strong belt on your trousers. I'm having those trousers off." And we were all quite amazed. I mean, the switch that took place in less than a minute. And this was double blind, remember, so she didn't know what she was getting. I didn't know what she was getting. But sure enough, when we broke the code, the one that she just had was the vodka. So she was absolutely correct. that vodka did arouse, you know, it was double blind, so she didn't know, but she was quite correct in observing this in herself, that vodka had an unpleasant reaction. What we also noticed was that whiskey, let me get this right, gin made her very depressed. She was extremely depressed on one of them, and when we broke the code, that was gin. And one of them made her extremely merry and giggly, and when we broke the code, that was whiskey. So what's the moral for all this? Well, the moral is that alcoholic drinks do behave differently, so you should explore them, and you should be aware that you may react very violently to one kind of alcoholic drink and be perfectly all right with others. I know somebody, for example, who goes into very dangerous, menacing rages on vodka. This person is very obnoxious to observe. Only on vodka, you know, drinking wine, no problem, and you know, other sorts of alcoholic drinks. So if you take my advice, you will either not drink — I'm not advising you not to drink — or if you do drink and you suffer, then you need to work out which drinks you can tolerate and which you can't. And the table goes roughly like this: dry white wine and champagne are the best tolerated. They're the least trouble, least amount of reaction. You heard me joke last time, I think, that I said I'm on record with the BBC as saying champagne is just a whole food with bubbles. There's nothing but bubbles and grapes in the bottle. Seems to be okay, and it's very well tolerated. So even if you have bad allergies, you might be okay with dry white wine. Not sweet white wine, there are hazards to the sugar, the sweetness. Dry white wine. Not trying to force it on you, okay? Why not red wine? You know, everyone knows that red wine is good for the heart, you know, the French and all that stuff. Well, the answer is that red wine has about 100 times the amount of histamine in it that there is in white wine. And if you know anything about allergies, then you'll know that histamine is bad news. It gives you headaches, makes you feel sleepy. It can cause difficulty in breathing, rashes on the skin, and feeling hot and red. Not good. So you don't want red wine for that reason. Next down the ladder — that's bottom of the table in a way — next down the ladder comes spirits. They're better tolerated because they're distilled, somewhat purified, but they still carry the characteristic essence of the food. So, for example, vodka — I mean, I know vodka is supposed to be potato, but it isn't. Modern vodka is made from corn or wheat or rye or other grains anyway. Whiskey, as you know, is made from rye, the bourbon kind, but the Scottish kind, that's made usually from malted barley or wheat. And people — I mean, that used to be one of our quick tests for somebody with a wheat allergy: no wheat for 5 days, and then a double scotch, and it would put the person in bed if they had a wheat allergy. You could do that for yourself if you're tough and brave, but I warn you, it can react quite strongly. Ted Randolph, who I've referred to, used to describe alcoholic drinks as jet-propelled food allergy, and he was not wrong. It was like the food allergic reaction, but sent in, you know, with a rocket blast. It made it faster, worse, and longer lasting than without the alcoholic presence. So be careful. But you know, the story with the girl that I was telling you about that reacted to vodka, she certainly reacted to corn, but not to wheat. So she was all right with whiskey. In fact, it made her merry. But if she had vodka — which 95% of vodka in the UK was made with corn, it's true here as well, by the way, you use corn — she could have probably had potato vodka, but really it's too risky, you know, for a young girl in her early 20s. I forgot to say, by the way, this girl's story got into the media. She very kindly agreed to the story, although the newspaper magazine did get a bit sleazy. You know, they dressed her in a basque and fishnet stockings and things, which are a bit uncalled for, but anyway, she's quite brave about it. She wanted to let people know, because this can be very dangerous for a woman if there's a certain alcoholic drink that will make you just fall all over the place or throw men to the floor and try and get there, expose them. It could be bad news. I mean, it's not just getting arrested. You could likely get yourself raped or even worse, you know, get yourself seriously hurt. So she was concerned that women should know this. Unfortunately, a lot of smart-ass men picked up on the article, and she used to find that they were constantly trying to spike her drinks with vodka. So a very sad after-effect for her. She would just simply have had to give up drinking. That's what people are like, isn't it? But You know, that was the story. So that's, it's really all brain allergy. I know I've gone on and on and on and on about alcohol. But if you think of alcohol, as I've just said, as jet-propelled food allergy, then it teaches us a great deal. And the brain effects can be quite extraordinary. So it can cause almost any kind of behavioural disturbance, violence particularly. I've had so many violent youths, I can't tell you, where it simply turned out to be something they were eating. Boys that you know, attacked their parents, attacked teachers, or on charges of assault and so on the streets, and it actually turned out to be something like that. So it's important to know, and if you've, there's somebody in your family that tends to be aggressive, this is what you need to look for. And of course, the biggest and the saddest part of the story is in kids. I'm sure you all know the story about, ADD, ADHD. Years ago, and I mean many years ago, before us pioneers got together, 30, 40 years ago, these kids were just diagnosed as mischievous, naughty, they were punished. And it took a long time to get this diagnosis established, that there really was a diagnosis of hyperactivity and attention deficit, and that it was a disease, disorder. You know, it wasn't, they were not naughty people, they're ordinary kids, because the minute you changed their diet and corrected this, the kid was calm, loving, lovely, intelligent, so they were able to study. But under the influence of the foods, they were a disaster. Now, it's very important to me that educators get to know this. They really they have to learn this. And I'm preparing myself this year to start going out lecturing to schools and colleges and to educators to get this very important message to them, that food reactions, hidden food reactions that nobody suspects, is very common. I'm talking 70-80% of the population. It may be just mild and life isn't as good as it could be, but it could lead to extreme violence. But more importantly, for the average child, it makes them unschoolable. Imagine the kind of reactions I've just talked to you about. The kid is fine all through the morning. Then they go and eat lunch. They eat a pizza or a pasta or something like that, loaded with wheat. They react. So they come back in the afternoon. They can't concentrate. They're jittery. They can't keep their thoughts together for more than a few seconds. They're probably, you know, maybe garrulous, aggressive and obnoxious to the teacher. They get infractions. They may get punished. And it's all the food and this, the teachers just, I almost said the stupid teachers, but they're ignorant rather than stupid. But, you know, the, all of this information has been in the public domain for a long time now, and I consider there's little or no excuse for teachers and educators not knowing that children can suffer adverse reactions due to food. Even if they don't go the whole hog, you know, with food allergy or food intolerance, that at least the quality of the diet is relevant to a child's behavior and whether a child is, frankly, whether a child is even educatable. On the typical diet that's eaten here in Mexico, it's loaded with corn, loaded with wheat, loaded with sugar, loaded with dairy produce, not to mention sodium and chemicals and all the other things. It's a wonder that the kids are educatable, and, you know, guess what? You look around, they're actually not educatable. The American standard of education has fallen so appallingly. You're way, way behind most of the civilized world. Kids are coming out of school. They can hardly read and write, certainly can't spell, and they're so difficult to educate, they don't even know. Most of them, I saw a survey, 50-odd percent of them couldn't even place America accurately on a world map. Never mind, you know, places like England and Afghanistan and all these hot spots in the world. In fact, one kid apparently said, you know, asked where England was, said, is that in London? I mean, that's how bad it's getting. I'm not here to complain at my host, but I'm here to say you have a serious problem. The American diet is the cause of an awful lot of it. And unless people wake up to this fact, you're going to lose a whole generation. They're just going to disappear down the drain, uneducated, ignorant, foolish, politically inept, meaning that they're easily swayed and moved and turned into political slaves by people who are willing to manipulate them and tell them what to do. They just plug in their Game Boys or their iPods and they don't want to know. Their eyes glaze over. And so far as they're concerned, the world doesn't exist. Well, you know, there's going to be some shocking awakenings someday soon. So I fear for you all, and we need to get this message through to people who are raising kids, that kids brought up in the way that they've been brought up in the last 20 or 30 years is a disaster. You know, one of the greatest, most powerful nations in the world is turning into a nation of zombies gradually, partly due to diet, partly due to electronic toys. But the point is, you can deal with the diet part. It's not difficult if you understand it. And it's a very big issue. I've just realized I'm on my soapbox. I do apologize. But you get what I'm saying. This is so important for teachers and educators. We've got to get the message out there somewhere. So one other thing, I'll just touch one other topic. I've already mentioned just ever so briefly to do with brain allergy, and that's epilepsy. Remember I mentioned that. This is severe brain overstimulation, but motor overstimulation. You can have sensory overstimulation, where the person gets overwhelmed by messages and doesn't really know what's happening. You can get motor overstimulation, where the person twitches and jitters, or if it's extremely severe, the person has a convulsion and they may be diagnosed as epilepsy. And I've seen kids with epilepsy due to all kinds of things, not even just food, but things, you know, environmental substances that they're reacting to. I did say somewhere, I can't remember where, recently, that I got one guy's driving license back who had a wheat allergy. He'd lost his license because of epilepsy. As you know, that's absolute grounds for losing your driving license. But he didn't have epilepsy, he had wheat allergy. So we managed to convince the authorities and got his license back. So again, another aspect of this very, very big topic of brain allergies. It's something that fascinates me. It's where most of my spectacularly interesting, amazing cases came from. And it's a subject that to me is very important. There are other things that can affect brain function, environmental chemicals, and you know, I've even seen it testing people for things like dust mite allergy, seen them behave peculiarly, look peculiar, have hallucinations and disturbance. But here I'm just talking about food, and food can do that. It's not even rare. You've got to understand, it's not even rare. One of the first organs that's going to suffer if you're having a food or any other kind of intolerance reaction is the brain. It's very delicately, finely balanced. It's wonderful how it works and how it's tuned, but you know, the least little thing will knock it off, in which case you stop being the authentic you, and you can become a very unpleasant, obnoxious you, even dangerous. So you need to be aware of that. Okay, well, I've done my hour. I've covered the topics that I particularly wanted to cover, and I hope you found those very interesting and helpful. I am going to open up the lines for questions. Remember, if you're on the webcast, that's fine, but you're going to have to call in if you want written questions. If you want verbal questions, I've got written questions. So now we're unmuted. So first of all, let me deal with Gary Sutton's question. Gary's asking something most of you wouldn't understand, but he's asking me about a special testing method for allergies, NAET, Nambudripad's allergy elimination testing. It's a muscle kind of testing technique. It's developed by an Indian lady called Nambudripad, hence its name. It's great. It's helpful, Gary. I'm not quite sure of the origin of this, since you've clearly heard about it, and you must know that it enjoys a good reputation. Nobody can quite say why it works, but I know in my book, Virtual Medicine, I've explained that tiny energetic traces can produce a lot more effect than big doses. So this could be important to you. Now, I can hear a voice. I don't know what else you want me to say here. Perhaps you're asking me, do I recommend them? The answer is yes, you could do that. It's a treatment system as well as a diagnostic system. If you can find a practitioner, it does have some value, certainly. There's nothing like being educated in the way I've described, and I would say read DietWise and go and find an NAT practitioner if you wish. It's quick and simple. It's certainly safe. So for those of you never heard of it, NAET stands for Nambudripad Allergy Elimination Technique. Okay, but let me tell you all that I'm going to be repeating all this material in the DietWise book website. I'll email the whole list anyway to tell you where to find it, but it will be something like dietwisebook.com/readingroom. And if you just go there, it will show you a page that will have a repeat broadcast or a repeat play of each of the broadcasts. So you can, I mean, those of you on the line have obviously heard it, so I'm not thinking of you, but you might want to send somebody there that you know needs to know this stuff. Send them over there to listen. And it will also include some relevant links and sources of information like this NAET thing. NAET is there on my website. If you go to alternative-doctor.com, click on allergies. And then when you go to the allergy section, click on testing. You'll find it's one of the techniques that I've covered there. Okay, so I hope you've found this interesting. I don't know, because most of you, by far the majority of people have been on the webcast, how many of you are readers and how many have done the diet and how many haven't, how many are listening and considering. wondering whether to buy the book or not, I can only tell you that you need this knowledge. You have to get it somehow, but everyone needs this knowledge. I called the book Diet Wise for a very good reason. It's probably not the most best-selling title, but it's telling people you need to know. This is telling you things about diet that nobody else knows. Your doctor is never going to know the things that I'm teaching here. They're just not interested anyway, but nobody's teaching them. So you're going to have to teach yourself. So I do advise you to get hip with this book, read it, and read it a couple of times, and most certainly try the elimination techniques that are described. The next broadcast, or if that's the word, or the next teleseminar webcast on this, then I shall be going straight into the technique. What do? How do you do it? How do you figure all this out? How do you make it work for you? Okay, thanks a lot. And that's good night. Take care. Bye now.